So Deltron was him on beats, me on turntables, and Del on rhymes, obviously. And then Lovage started with Dan, Mike Patton, and Jennifer Charles. And then I was kind of recruited for the turntable work again. But we did a tour. I think it was maybe, I think we only did 12 shows or something like that. And then everybody's schedule got a little too insane to...
That's a lot of people to corral.
Yeah, yeah. But it was fun, yeah.
I had Dan on the show at some point last year. Is he the one who kind of brought you into that scene?
Yeah, for those projects, definitely. I had done some work with him and Paul for Handsome Boy Modeling School since the first one, actually. And then I remember being on tour with Handsome Boy Modeling School. We were playing the Tibet Freedom Concerts.
Those must have been huge.
Yeah, and we were in, you know, the smaller hip hop tents or something like that. But I remember Del and Dan speaking backstage about this idea that Del had, this character Deltron Zero that he wanted to bring to life. And yeah, I was there for that conversation where it started. And then a few months later, it was like, yeah, you remember that thing we were kind of talking about? And so it was fun. Yeah. By then it had already been quite realized. A lot of the tracks that were played for me had Del had already written on them and stuff. So it was pretty fun. Such evocative stuff he was writing for that project. So it was cool. It was like, it had to take it more like a Morricone style music project where the turntable had to kind of help breathe that feeling into those tracks.
When you say Morricone, you mean cinematic?
Yeah, a bit cinematic, but also it's just in terms of layers too, and in terms of tones that Dan was wanting, you know, what type of way he just wanted the stuff to blend, you know, but to definitely elicit this sort of cinematic or almost Western style, like future Western vibe to it.
I'm glad you brought up Handsome Boy Modeling School. That's actually the other Prince Paul project I was thinking of. And in a weird way, I know this is not at all accurate, but in a weird way, in my brain, those form like a kind of trilogy almost.
Yeah. I mean, well, Dan and Paul, you know, I don't know if I could speak to that. I think all of us sort of have multiple things that are cooking at the same time. And, yeah, when the schedules align, it's always a wonderful, you know, excursion. So anytime either of those dudes call me for something, I'm like, yeah, let's go.
It's that there's, you know, overlap with the musicians, that they kind of came out at roughly the same time. And they're all three of them are like really high concept.
Hmm. Yeah. That's definitely a Dan thing, but also personally, I've always liked concepts. I find them fun to work with in terms of just having, it's not even a restriction, but just having the sort of base narrative that you're trying to compose to or speak to with your work. So Dan's pretty clear. I mean, when on the Deltron stuff, he's definitely like a director sort of role, and he'll say funny things like, okay, at the end of this, we need this rock skipping over water type of, you know, furious, but futuristic sound. And other times he's like, all right, now we need something a little more, you know, melancholic, but at the same time, optimistic, and, you know, channel that. It's never really, it's more like a mood he's going for. And so that's why I like working with him on that. He kind of leaves it open in terms of, like, he knows what part of the track he hears something happening, but then he kind of gives you space to come up with something that'll work.
The mood thing is interesting because that is something that really, that is kind of the milieu that you work in when you're doing scores, you know, and I know that you've operated in that world a bit, but it is interesting to have a project and sort of the one, you know, the one piece of guidance somebody gives you is something as abstract as a mood.
Yeah. I enjoy that, though. I like the challenge of it. It's not like, here's this record, scratch this record in 30-second note rhythm, but shuffly. It's like nothing like that. It's more, I mean, there's an energy to it. It's obviously set up with the track and how Del kind of rolls in and out of the verses and stuff. And then, I don't know, my role there is just sort of try to support it, lift it, or keep up with it moments, or just provide a break from it other times. So, yeah.
I mean, knowing what I know about you, you don't strike me as somebody who would necessarily thrive with that level of hand-holding of people like really micromanaging you.
I think on a core level, we all sort of enjoy the same types of music, inspired by the same types of films even. So it just kind of goes without saying. I can kind of get a feel for what direction they're going for on a track, and then just try to augment that feeling with the turntables, whatever it is. Sometimes it'll just be a counterpoint, a harmony counterpoint, or sometimes it's a lead, you know, choir line or something. Other times it's just more rhythmic and acrobatic, if that's what the track calls for. So, but I don't know, you know, it's fun. It's, I don't think Dan tells Del like, okay, you need to write like this.
I don't think anybody tells Del that.
It's just one of those things. We just bring what we bring to the table, and he kind of makes sure everything's balanced. Yeah.
Is that pretty standard for you as far as how collaborations go in the sense that, like, you know, obviously it is collaborative in a broader sense, but that you're really kind of like working alone and then bringing that thing to the table?
No, I mean, Dan actually loves to hang out and rapport when we work. By that, I mean, he loves Montreal, so any excuse for him to come up here to record, he will, you know, because he just likes the scene up here, great record stores, great restaurants, you know, all his favorite things. So it's more just hanging out, playing the music, talking about the music. And then when it is actually time to work, it's often, you know, if it's something like, okay, I need to work on this. I remember on event two, there was a few things that I wanted, just a little more elaborate, like layered harmony stuff. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to go dig up some bits and just practice them for a while and just see, you know, what I can build with that. And in that case, he's like, cool, I'll be back in an hour. And, you know, I'll play it for him after. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. And then, Other moments, you know, like I said, it might just be a more straight up percussion style scratching thing, and you might need bits of that or something. Like, okay, let's just like knock this out, you know? And so I could do that. That was more like a one take thing. And then he's more engineering in those situations. But other times, you know, it might take me a while to just find the right stuff to layer in.
You mentioned that you just got back from Brazil, and I was listening to some interviews you had done fairly recently, and yeah, you're working with a singer, is that right?
Leilani, yeah. Yeah, on tour. Yeah, we have one song together on the new album, on my new album, Creatures of the Late Afternoon. And so I had such a great time recording that with her that I said, hey, do you want to jump on a couple of these shows? You can play a couple of your songs, like play a couple of my tunes. We can play, you know, I was kind of backing her up on some of her songs. And then similarly, she was backing me up on a couple songs, just like actually taking the parts, like the drums, piano, bass, you know, horns and stuff, and actually mapping it out on her MPC. And she's able to do it live. So just the two of us, it's been a lot of fun. It's almost like, I don't know, in the tradition of the Black Keys or the White Stripes or something, this sort of
the duo
outfit, only it's MPC and turntables, but we're enjoying just with that framework, the range of stuff we're able to do, including some of our own solo material and stuff. But, and of course we'll do that track. Things are going to change, and we're working on some stuff together also. So she's great. She's a phenomenon and such a joy to be on the road with. She's just kind of getting started. I know a lot of these places that we're playing, she's never even been to before. So it's fun to, you know, have Leilani up there, and, you know, to maybe a crowd that's not unfamiliar with her, and just watching the light bulbs go up over their heads, like, oh my gosh, this is crazy, like what she's able to do, because she could do the MPC stuff, but you know, the finger drumming, I think that's what she calls it, that but then layer in all the bass lines and the harmonies and sing over it and not miss the beat. It's really quite phenomenal, you know.
The White Stripes analogy is an interesting one, because I mean, obviously, like, if you're Jack White, obviously Jack White can do a ton on a guitar, but you know, given the tools that each of you have, you are kind of a one person band, you know, and you can really get this full sound. So it's interesting to collaborate with somebody else who has that tool set.
Yeah, it is, because like sometimes it might be, oh, she's responsible for the rhythm section part of things, and we're dealing with the tops and the vocal scratches and all those things that I'm adding in, or similarly the other way around. Like I might actually be rocking the beats, looping the back beat, you know, on a couple records, and she's throwing in all the vocal punctuations off her MPC. And I don't know, the fact that it's live, the fact that we're not on a grid, you know, we're not just hitting space bar and then letting a machine do all the work, the fact that it could fall apart any second, and there's an urgency to it that I really enjoy. You know, because if we stop or if we get tired, it's like song stops, you know. So, and I think the audience kind of, you know, feels that. I think that one of the most exciting bits in the set right now is just where we're freestyling off this break that she put together, and we're just kind of, we're still working out. We've only done maybe a handful of shows together, but it's been a lot of fun.
So most of the stuff is like improvisational to a certain extent, but working within a set framework?
No, I would say right now, most of it is like she brought a few of her songs that she wanted to perform. And then I had a few songs or tracks that I wanted to do. Like, for instance, one would be Skanky Panky, which is a track that I put out, what, like 20 years ago.
That's like a ska song, right?
Ska tune. But and I've done it in many iterations. Like on one tour, I had DJ P-Love and DJ Jester with me. We did it almost like a turntable band on 8 turntables. So Jester was just bass and drums. I was the sort of call section, and then Paulo had all the kind of response sections. So it was a very kind of dynamic 3 turntable version of it. And then when I DJ solo, I kind of do more just the horns and the kind of lead scratches over a back beat version of it. The skank itself would just be on a 3rd turntable playing. And now with Leia, it's almost like, oh, well, she can break it up and do the drums and the backbeat stuff live. And so it has a different energy, still the same track, but it has this kind of new twist on it, which I'm enjoying. So that's basically it, just starting that way, just because we haven't had that much time to just sit for a couple months and just write all new stuff. It's like, okay, let's just get to know each other and see, these are the types of tracks that I would like to see what we could pull off, you know, if we just broke it down to MPC and turntable, like how could we, you know, how could we iterate that, you know, in a live context that would work.
You know, that this idea that they have at, like, you know, like fancy hoity-toity restaurants of like deconstructed foods, deconstructed banana split with like these 3 ingredients. you know, and I'm somebody like I was a big ska kid back in the day. I have like a deep affinity to that music, and two tracks in that time period that you did that are connected in my mind as that sort of deconstruction are that and was it Basin Street Blues?
Oh right, yeah.
Effectively, like I don't know, the sense that I get from them is, you know, you sort of being enamored with a kind of music and then trying to figure out how what your take would sound like.
Yeah, just sort of seeing if I could bring the turntables into that realm and see how it would fit. Sometimes it would be an awkward, you know, again, it does come from just a love of that music to start. But I remember like just growing up listening to jazz music in the house, my father would play vocal jazz records all the time. Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald. That's like my home music, you know.
I mean, that's some of the best music ever put on record.
Yeah, like I'll play it and I'll just feel at home, not just nostalgic for my childhood. And like now I just continue to play it as the most played, you know, records in my house. So even my kids now, we don't live in New Orleans, but they've heard those records thousands of times. So I remember with Basin Street Blues, it was actually my father who said, hey, when he noticed that this music thing was kind of working out a little bit and I started to travel, he said, hey, if your travels take you to New Orleans, make sure you go see this music performed live. And so he says he did that when he was in college and it was like a spiritual experience for him. And so I did that. I had a gig in New Orleans and I went to see Preservation Hall. And they did a version of Basin Street Blues that was just so incredible. And I remembered the Sweet Emma Preservation Hall record that my father had too, which started with a version of Basin Street Blues. And so to see that live, you know, after hearing it as a child so much was just incredible. And then I continued to go to, I don't know, five or six different jazz clubs over the next 2-3 days, and every ensemble, every band played a version of Basin Street Blues in their set. So that song was just ringing in my head, you know. And I was on the plane flying home and I said, I don't know what the next album was going to be. I was about to start work on some of my best friends are DJs, and I said, I don't know what it's going to be, but I know I want to start it with a turntable version of Basin Street Blues, just because that song was so present in that whole trip. And I was so inspired by that whole trip. So the first thing I did when I got back was, not deconstruct, but I had to figure out the chords. And then it was totally not like a jazz way of making a jazz song. Like I remember writing the charts out and saying, okay, here are the chords. And then just actually, it's very naive, but I was like drawing lines between notes on the staff, just trying to figure out, okay, well, if this is the trombone and it should go from this note to this note,
You were doing that like FBI thing with the pictures and the yarn on the cardboard.
Exactly, yeah. And making sure you know, cause I guess when you're playing live in a jazz ensemble, explained to me that you're just playing around the chords and you're just trying not to land. Like if you both land on one note, then one of you needs to bend up or down or something so that everybody's just kind of out of each other's way, but also the chaos of it is like the joyful part. So my version was a little less, didn't have that ability to go there because I had to do every layer myself. So I know, you know, to me, like that music sounds best when it's an ensemble of people playing it in one take together and improvising. But for me, it was like, oh, I was just improvising kind of off older layers that I had already recorded and they weren't responding back to me. It was just like, I was just trying to find the room for the next layer and bending it in and out. But it was a fun experiment. It took me like 6 months to put that track together and just even, you know, finding like an A flat held note on a clarinet on some classical record and then practicing to bend it into the chord cycle. It took me months to do it, but I guess the happy ending to that story is that I would almost say it was like a year after the album came out or something, we got a call from Preservation Hall saying, yeah, and saying that they had seen the video on YouTube and wanted to invite me to go play with the band. And I said, what? You're Preservation Hall? Like, I got to do a
concert. Like, who am I?
Traditional jazz. And they, and it was like, I don't know, it was such an honor to go down there. And they actually started the set with my version of Basin Street Blues, just the video. They screened that on a little pull down, you know, screen. And at the end of it, the band just took over. They started playing over it, and then they kept it going and walked on stage. And I was bawling.
That's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. It was definitely like one of the biggest highlights of my entire career. I played in a lot of like wild contexts, but that moment, I don't know, it just all seemed to come full circle a bit. And then I got to play like turntables with the band and, you know, basically get my ass kicked on stage, but like trying to like figure out just to keep up. But that was the fun part. You know, I remember this like, okay, you trade with the trumpet player, and he's just throwing licks at me like two bars, and then I have to like kind of respond and keep up with him. And I just, within those like 32 bars of, you know, musical conversation, I think I learned more about music than, you know, literally 10 years of DJing by myself. It was just just everything about it. Like, it still affects me. I could just think about it now and that energy. It was exciting, but then it's also like educational and then also familiar because I'd been listening to that type of music my whole life, just never had the opportunity to play it in that context, you know?
One of the defining characteristics of like New Orleans jazz specifically, or like Dixieland jazz, is that everybody's playing at the same time. You know, it's not like more modern jazz where people are kind of taking turns. Like, there's like six instruments all going at the same time. And like, you know, and I know you collaborate a lot, but still what you do, I would expect a lot of time is fairly solitary. A lot of it is just sort of like you in the, probably in the room that you're in right now, like your lab or your dungeon, putting music together. So that opens an entire new world to just be on stage with these incredible musicians, you know, playing at the same time.
Yeah. I've played in many contexts and bands, and now with chamber music, trios and quartets, string quartets and things like that. But I would say what's special about, yeah, playing like with a trad jazz band is like, you have to completely just be on your toes. Every single moment is this decision that you have to make and still blend and uplift, and you know the chords, you know where they're going. I knew they're playing mainly standards, so I knew most of them, but they would call it in a different key. Like, it might not be the version that I'd listen to, you know, and they're pretty much just like, you know, like When You're Smiling or something, and I'm like 3/4, and they would just call the key and then go, and you know, it would take me like half bar to figure out what key,
and then, yeah, and the time signature, it sounds like.
Yeah, but you know, they play every day there, you know. That's it's still a mecca to me every day in that context. So as a band, I think they just breathe like one organism already, you know. So for me, it was a lot of it just like, oh, I just got to keep up, you know. And I definitely feel like there's a rite of passage for me. I know at some point in my life I'm going to move there and just play. Yeah, it's might be a strange thing for a scratch DJ to say, but for me it's like, oh no, this is something I aspire to be able to attain, like that level of fluency, you know, and with that much great music.
It might be a strange thing for a scratch DJ to say, but I would say following your career, and anybody who knows the remotest thing about you, they know not to attempt to predict where you're going.
Yeah. <I guess. laughs> Yeah, I don't know. I do always want to see what's next or where else I can bring it. And I think with turntables as an instrument for me, you know, since the first time I heard scratching, it was an immediate fascination with the craft. And then just over the last several decades, just practicing and then trying to push it to possibly different areas or way, you know, opportunities have come up where it's like, hey, can you find a way to play on this or add something to this? And I think it's just maybe, yeah, I have to just thank the collaborators and all the bands that would put me on, like Money Mark or even Bullfrog, like the band I played in college. I was the youngest one in the band. They were, you know, at the time I was like, I only listened to hip hop or something like that, you know, or maybe a couple funk records. And I was very, you know, laser focused on that. And then they kind of opened like my mind up to the fact, oh, well, you know, that Public Enemy record that you love so much, they actually sampled Maceo or Pee Wee Ellis, trying to, you know, understand. They were the one that connected those dots to me. And then, so then I started, my ears kind of started, the range just kind of got wider. But then I remember, you know, especially Money Mark, like there was, you know, I knew him from the Beastie Boys stuff. And when he asked me to tour with him, I was like, of course, you know. And, you know, but when I was on tour with him, I realized just his knowledge of music is just so, so, so deep. And even within his own set, he could go from, you know, like an Elvis Costello type pop song to this weird instrumental, you know, ska track, but Money Mark style to a ballad, and it would still be his kind of world. And sometimes he would ask, "Is there something you could do on the turntables here that would suit it?" And I was like, "Well, this is a ballad. Like, what would I do on that? That wouldn't be distracting. Like, could I find something tasteful and like a support turntable part?" And I remember one of the songs, which I loved, was Cry. It was off his first album, Mark's Keyboard Repair. And he's like, you think you can find something to do on this? It's like, well, what do you mean? Like a beat or something? It's like, cause really the track was just over a really kind of minimal drum machine loop. And it was mostly about his Hammond organ bass and his voice. And there was one descending bass line, and I said, okay, well, maybe I could find a way to like do the bass part on turntable. But again, like not just trying not to distract from the point of that song to me is his singing, you know. But that just led me to dig at the time in different areas and try to find bits of records that I could use more, you know, harmonically and more as like sometimes as a keyboard role or a backup vocalist role or something like that. And not just like, okay, here's the DJ section, and then I have to do something real flashy or something. Cause sometimes it was a ballad. It didn't need it. You know,
you serve the song.
Yeah, always. I try to, I hope. It's pretty clear when you're on stage, you know,
if it's working,
whether you become the sideshow or whether you just become part of the main feeling of the song. And I think that's, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with scoring film too, right? You have to leave the space for all the other elements to work their magic too. So the music can be very powerful. Yes, but it's not just about the music, you know? And I think playing in bands is that's a difference between that and like just DJing alone. At that point, you're like, you know, 100% of what's coming out of the speakers is what you decide to drop your needle on or whatever. So these are your choices, and how you chop it up is like still your choices. But I think the second there's more than one person on stage, there's this like interesting space that you have to make. And in that space is just a lot of surprising stuff that can happen. That's why I enjoy doing it. Yeah.
That was such an interesting time for DJ music. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of, it broke my brain a bit. You know, you mentioned you mentioned like the Hammond on Money Mark, and I'm thinking about like DJ Shadow of like, in a strange way, like almost building more traditional music. Like you listen to the DJ Shadow stuff and it's like, oh, this is just like some pretty straightforward music that he's building.
But the fact that he's doing it on these like 12-bit machines and like rephrasing, using the MPC, I think that's what I love about Shadow stuff is that, yeah, there's a deep musicality to it, but then there's a deep, you know, chop culture, you know, that chop approach of hip hop production is in there. And I think for me with turntables, that's really still like kind of my ground zero. I still, if I have it on vinyl, then there's like a million options. You know? So I think even with this current, with Creatures, it was like, I might write something on guitar or something that works harmonically for the chorus or the bridge, but then I would cut it to vinyl because I have a record cutter now. I'm that big a nerd. But once it was on vinyl, then I would say, oh, I can rephrase, you know, I get two copies of this and I can like shuffle or stutter the either the drums.
They can play off each other.
Exactly. And I can have the note, the music content in there, but it's kind of can sound more Frankenstein with the pickup scratches and stuff. And, oh, I can repeat that second note. The guitar line normally would naturally do this, but on turntables, I could repeat the second note and then pull it back and then let it go again. And I still have like all the, I don't know, like the, even though the melody in essence would change, I would still have all the harmonic content I wanted in that part of the song. So back to your deconstructed food thing, I think that's really what it came down to, is like working on a record like Creatures of the Late Afternoon. It was like, okay, it's like you're going to make a salad, but first you got to grow the tomatoes. Down to that, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, I'm gonna go make the source material first by writing it, and then if I just put that version of the record out, it would have just sounded more like a layered bedroom one person band album or something. But I think once it was on the vinyl, like I could really just break it out and approach it from you know, a different angle, and it gave it that kind of push and pull that I like, you know, because I don't know, it's just not like perfectly quantized. It's always a little bit, you know, chasing itself, and it has that energy that I've always liked about of live beat juggling or DJing, you know, in the hip hop style, yeah.
You're almost like you're almost working backwards into this more traditional style of music making. Cause you were describing earlier, you know, trying to find, I don't remember if you said it was like A minor or A sharp or whatever on a clarinet on an album. And now it's just like, oh yeah, I can play these instruments competently. I could just make that thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On Creatures, I would like sometimes just play a line on a woodwind instrument and it would work. It would even be in tempo, you know, for that moment in the song. But then I think the fun part of it, like the fun part of hip hop, at least that era that I was first introduced to, which would have been like, it takes a nation of millions to hold us back. And like De La Soul, Three Feet High and Rising, those records where it was like, oh, I know that those two elements didn't exist together. That's a drum beat from the 50s and that's like a bass line from the 80s and, you know, a spoken word bit from the 30s. And it was like this impossible quantum leaping of sounds of these imaginary, you know, time traveling bands. That's what I felt like I was listening to, you know. So it was like, oh, okay, so what if you take a surf beat from, you know the 60s and then you add that like fuzz guitar from a 70s rock thing. And so that was more it, you know, in terms of how this record came together. It was just really getting into tones at first. I mean, it was a long pandemic, you know, so just in the lab kind of saying, oh yeah, I'm just going to try every single combination of compressor and whatever distortion.
People taught themselves how to bake bread and you were like, I'm just going to.
Yeah, I didn't do the bread thing. I was like more in the studio, but I was, yeah, essentially trying to see, you know, how much, you know, what, how much water do we add to the flour of the fuzz pedal? You know what I mean? To get the right doughiness. That's exactly the way I spent my time. And so, but once that was it, I mean, that was just a voyage of discovery. So even tracks like When You Say Love or something, which was more like a, I don't know, like a vocal group, 60s, 50s, 60s jukebox kind of thing, just trying to get certain tones out of the instruments just to start, just from a production level, just kind of giving myself that task of seeing if I could at first just approximate the sound, knowing that I'm never going to get it without actually like being that type of player in that time recording at the studio, but then using what I had to just try to see if I could take, you know, nod to some of those tones, like in terms of how the bass sounds, how the drum sounds, and yeah, like growing your own tomatoes. and then chopping them up and putting them in with all the other parts and seeing what happens. Yeah.
Are you a perfectionist?
I'm a perfectionist in terms of it keeping its imperfections, if that makes any sense. Like, I know nowadays there's this ability to just polish everything until it's,
yeah, Pro Tools or Logic or whatever.
Yeah, that is not lifeless, but it's kind of expected or too.
It can be lifeless. I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but we've heard those records where it's like, oh, they literally produced this thing to death.
Right. I think, you know, I just like stuff that sounds a bit broken, that sounds a bit, and which makes sense too, because it'd be authentic to my studio, since most of the stuff in my studio is kind of like half broken or some pawn shop line or something like that. Or you're like, oh, okay, well, these key, you know, there's literally some keys broken off some of the keyboards I have, but instead of getting it fixed and brought back up to like factory spec, I'm like, yeah, but there's still this lower octave I can play on. You know what I mean? And so I just kind of use, like, squeeze out whatever the machines allow me to do, or the instruments allow me to do, and record it and then see how it goes. But I'm not too precious on it being like, it's funny, it's not until now where it's like playing with some string ensembles like quartets and trios, and the idea of chamber music actually being like, okay, well, there's four or five of us now, and the whole point is that we all have different instruments, but we need to sound like one voice, you know? And that was kind of the idea of like, they're all drifting with each other, but there's a center note. That's like, that's the new thing, where what used to be like, oh, here's A440 and just like tune to that. I think when you're playing in chamber music style, like if they start bending, then the whole quartet has to bend together. And that's like a whole other level of surfing. That's like pretty awesome. But I think, yeah, studio, I'm more just like, I don't mind if it's like kind of out of tune or wonky. In fact, I enjoy that about the vinyl. I enjoy that, you know, the surreality of it. It's like, hey, the warble on that doesn't even sound like if you played a guitar note string and it just sort of decayed, but because it's on a warped piece of vinyl, it might just have a little bit of a different vibrato. And I love that. I love all that stuff. And I think for the people that are paying attention, they might listen to it like, oh, that sounds like a 50s jukebox jam or something. And then they listen closer, like, wait, that's not even a real guitar. Or it is a real guitar, but it's like scratched in off a turntable and it echoes out like by hand. And it just it has these little things where it's just kind of, I don't know, like a turntablized version of it, I guess. But I don't know. I think I wouldn't, it's just listening to those eras of records, like the Phil Spectors and the Brian Wilsons and those things.
The Hell of Sound. And
sounds, you know, how, okay, you know, say we bring like a harpsichord with mixed with this thing, and they were trying to get a new instrument out of fusing too. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm doing that, but just with turntables parts. Yeah.
I would liken it. It's interesting. I would liken it to, obviously, like, you know, traditionally when we're talking about samples, even if it's like De La Soul or Paul's Boutique or whatever, it's like, you know, you're building off of existing music, right? And that's where the crate digger culture comes in. And it's really cool. And it's probably an incredible experience. I've never experienced it to find, you know, this magical thing in the crate, but you're almost building imaginary music that you're sampling.
Exactly. And I would say
it's like an alternate history.
Getting just more and more molecular, right? At this point, it's like, okay, well, I only need, you know, in this part, I just hear like a whatever, like an E minor chord on a Hammond, and then I can play that E minor chord. There's many ways I could do it. I just play it on a Hammond, just play it, and then cut that to vinyl and scratch it as a complete Hammond part. Or I could say, okay, I could break that chord up and just find each of the notes, which is how I did it on Basin Street Blues, for instance, find the different notes on different instruments and still get the feeling of that E minor chord, but have each layer or each note of the chord be scratched, you know. And there's just options of it just being kind of like a weird ensemble of turntables. Like, to me, I felt like I just wanted it to sound a bit like if the cast of the Muppet Show each had like a mixer and a Technics 1200 and they did that whole opening song, you know? how would that sound, you know? And every one of them as a character, you know, has already would approach it differently. Say how Animal plays the drums, which is just the type of personality and the type of energy he has. No, so for me, Creatures of the Late Afternoon is kind of like my version. And I was like, what would it sound like if a praying mantis was on the SP-1200 or something, you know, or whatever, a sloth playing fuzz bass, you know, what kind of bass lines would that sloth write? And I kind of just had fun with, you know, using my imagination to go there with it, partly because it was a pandemic and there wasn't the ability to be like, hey, I'm just gonna go like call my buddies who play this and that instrument and come in and just like play around the studio.
I mean, you can do that right now. You can have somebody record something remotely and send it to you.
Yeah, but I'm more like, I've always felt like the best, or at least for me, is just like when people are in the room vibing together and just hanging, you know. So yeah, so again, it was a lot of just having fun in the studio, trying to surprise myself with some of the sounds or some of the even comical moments on the record were like just having fun with the idea. Like, I remember the track Password, which is like so dumb little turntable skit track, but it was, you remember, like everybody, like we're here, like this is a new program you're introducing me to that we're recording this podcast on. But at the time, for a while there, it felt like we were signing up for, I don't know, like 8 or 9 different new apps or something. And I couldn't remember any of the passwords ever. Like, it would literally be, I just signed up to this like yesterday and I can't remember. And so, I don't know. For me, it was the idea of like, oh, you know, I just have to document this somehow, how ridiculous, like, it got. And so that track is just a turntable like skit about somebody forgetting all their passwords, but then scratching like a typewriter sound, like somebody on the keys and like getting it wrong and groaning. Having fun with that.
I like that because it's, you know, like pandemic records. There was a lot of conversations around this when the pandemic was really at its height in the early days of like, you know, is there going to be a new wave of pandemic art, and how annoying is it going to be, you know, to have lived through it and then deal with it again in music? But I like this idea of finding like a little almost forgotten piece of minutiae. You know, you're not talking about this huge global thing that's affecting everybody. It's just this like little annoying thing that you were dealing with and building a song around that.
Yeah, and again, like, that's forgetting your password, first world problem of the highest order. So it was just
but really universal boring. In the first world.
Yeah, yeah, and just how silly that felt. But as it started to congeal, like, the whole concept of creatures, like, I was painting, like, during the daylight hours, these creatures playing instruments, and then that was feeding into the, you know, when the sun would set, and that's when I'd normally go into the studio, that would just still be kind of floating around in my consciousness. And then I was starting to just try to create the sounds for this cast of, you know, my version of the musical Muppets or whatever. And so it kind of would just feedback loop a bit into that. And then some of those skit tracks ended up being like, oh, okay, this could work in a story. So now even the password track is going to be a music cue in a forthcoming stage production that we're working on based on Creatures of the Late Afternoon in the style of, say, The Storyville Mosquito, which is on tour now, or Newfoundland's Fall, which is on tour like 8 years ago. So this will be the third show in that style. And it became like, okay, now this whole thing is a cast of these creatures, these endangered animals that are coming together and going to save the Natural History Museum through the power of music.
That tracks.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that led to like that idea, once it kind of reared its head, was like, oh, then we need like that third act showdown track, you know, the denouement, you know. So Rise of the Tardigrades was that specifically. I needed a track that felt like that final battle. I needed a track that felt like the epilogue. I needed a track that felt like the you know, a couple of the creatures, there's a love story, obviously, that, you know, that spoke to that. And that's when the album came from, just these sort of weird experiments, to the 20 tracks that ended up on the record. It's like, okay, well, that actually has to be the score for the show. So all of it, including the intro, like, here now, like, I already feel like I know what that's going to look like on stage, and how the title of the show comes in, even with the letters spelling out the Creatures of Late Afternoon, like all that. So it really was just kind of, you know, congealing as a concept, like, over the last, whatever it was, 3 years. And yeah, so, but I'm excited about it. I'm happy that whether people pick up on that now, like, I do think it just stands like as something you can listen to as an album, that not even.
It has to, because it predates the show by a significant amount of time.
Yeah, like, we're just in pre-production now, and I think our premiere earliest will be 2 years from now. So even tracks like Things Are Gonna Change with Leilani, it was like, I had made the beat and I had written the words, and I was like, I just need someone who has like that voice, who can like really give it that energy. But it's almost like the track that I know in the show is kind of like this is not finalized yet, but it's the type of track that you'd put on. It would be during the montage where they all come together and try to, like, say, clean up an old cabin in the woods and make their new headquarters or something like that. Just like that type of energy of people kind of coming together and working together on something, you know? So that, yeah, a lot of those things just started telling me what they needed, you know, the tracks themselves. And then when that concept for the narrative came in, it became very clear to me what was left that I needed to maybe write and record to put in to segue into the next part of the story. Yeah.
Is that the case in all three of these, where the narrative like effectively emerged out of the music?
No, Newfonia started actually as a graphic novel. I'd written that as a book first. There was this theme about a robot in it trying to write love songs. And when the publisher saw that in the story, Emma Mackay, who worked at the ECW Press at the time, said, hey, what does that song sound like? And she was the one who kind of pushed me towards like, okay, well, I actually have to go record this song now. There's this whole scene dedicated to it, the robots in the studio. And like, she was just curious. She's like, cause if you had that recording, we could include it with the book and make a soundtrack to the book. And that was my first opportunity to quote score something, was just because Emma was wondering, you know, she's like, yeah, maybe we should package it with that robot love song. What does it sound like? And so then, you know, after that with Storyville Mosquito, I'd written that, but I was just poking around with a few music cues here and there. But that one really came together more during the live show production of it. Like, there's a storyboarded version of it too, which would also be a graphic novel if I finally decided to release it as such. But it was more like the concept and the story first, and then writing to each cue. And then once we start doing it live on stage and they're realizing, oh, we actually need even more music. There's a couple moments here where this happens and we need a motif for that, or some sort of, you know, variation of a theme here just to keep it rolling. And it's more organic that way. And then this one, I guess, was, it started as like musical experiments. I had this idea of these creature bands, but I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know whether it was going to be one creature band or like a whole legion of them or whatever. But I was just kind of following the muse and just seeing what would happen. Really.
I feel like so much of like failure isn't even failure. It's feeling like things are impossible. So never really taking that risk and never putting yourself out there and never allowing yourself to like fail in a public way. And I'm guessing so I've seen footage from both. I haven't seen either of them in person. I've seen footage from both of them. And it's incredible that it was pulled off. You know, obviously a lot of really talented people involved, but watching it, it's like, this is wild that this is a thing that exists. There must have been points in the process of doing this entirely new thing where it felt impossible.
So yeah, I guess for the benefit of the people listening, these are shows that we've been touring more recently, which are essentially live film. So there's 15 performers on stage. There's like 8 cameras, I think 75 puppets, multiple miniature sets, and we perform. The puppet team is on stage with us. We perform light, film, project, score, and Foley everything in one take live. From a performance perspective, it's like one of the most exciting things that I've been able to be a part of. And it's always such a joy. But yes, I think it's because it can fall apart at any second that makes it that the lack of safety net is really what it is. It's not like we finish a set and then, or we finish a scene and say, all right, cut. We're going to reset the next one. Everybody in the audience, take a popcorn break and we'll be right with you. No, like once we start, we actually have to do the show like you're watching a movie in real time. And the fun part of it, I think, for the audience is that they get to watch the story unfold on screen, but then they can look under the hood, see all the scurrying around to make all these practical effects happen on the screen, you know, sometimes using movie magic and in terms of just, oh, it could be as simple as like a, you know, old chap trick where you just turn the camera 90 degrees and all of a sudden it looks like the gravity is can change just because of the orientation of the camera.
Yeah, they call it in-camera effects.
Yeah, in-camera effect. Like, we just have so much fun with the idea of that it's live and that it's not like pre-recorded and that we're not slave to this, you know, click track or anything like that. We can pretty much just do it on the spot. But yeah, there were many moments where I guess, yeah, some of the things are still quote impossible, you know, but what I love about those shows is that they're alive and they're continually evolving. So we do notes after each show, you know, maybe one of the puppeteers would say, oh, I didn't think the scene like landed, like we can make it funnier or we can make it more poignant or, you know, and then we all think about how we can do that. Is it the camera angle? Is it the music? Is it, you know, the blocking of the the puppets. And so it's constantly, as we, the more we do the show, the more settled we get with it. But then I never wanted it to be like, oh, we're just up there going through the motions, like we've got this nailed, and then we just keep doing the same show over and over again. I wanted it to design it so that it would evolve. So for instance, everywhere we go, no matter what city it is or country it is, we'll localize what we're doing a bit. We'll change some of the sets. We'll build like local landmarks and then add in local cuisine jokes or whatever we need to do to just like bring us into that moment. And so the audience knows it's like, hey, this isn't the same show they just did in Chile or whatever last month. This is like for us. And what's interesting is like, there's some things that are quote still impossible, like in terms of on my original boards or something. Hey, I thought we could make this happen. And they're like, we're still always trying to figure out some things. Like an example recently, I mean, we've done Storyville Mosquito, I guess I'm in like 8 cities now. But it wasn't until Taiwan over the holidays, we were over there, that we figured out a way to make it rain in terms of like actually overlay rain into it in a live way that looked convincing. And we did that by actually, it was a very simple hack. It was like a lot of kind of MacGyvering of like, we kind of made this top hat out of black construction paper. And then we put LED lights on the inside of it. And then we cut little diagonal slits in it. Okay. And then we put it on one of my turntables that can actually play, I think 100% or 200% slower than normal or almost, you know, that doesn't make sense. If it was 200% slower, it'd just be off, but it can go really, really slow. Like it's like an octave lower than you're locked zero. So it's like very slowly rolling. But then when we put the camera shooting the side and fill the whole frame with it, those little slits of light bleeding through and having it turn slowly on a turntable made it look like it was raining on the screen. And it was one of those things where it was such a victory for us because it was something I wanted even for our premiere of the show. And we just never figured out a way that looked, you know, that convincing. And so with something like that, sometimes that flash of inspiration, like, hey, maybe we should try using the turntable. It's like, what? Like actually as the turntable for a set piece, which was something, you know, normally it was like, oh, the musicians are over here, we wouldn't put a camera over here. But we tried it and it works, and it's just, you know, so now that's part of the show for that moment. You know, all of a sudden, like, everybody has so many cues in the show, like, I got to reload these turntables, and then I got to play this piano bit over here, then the strings take over, and then I pick up this, you know, start playing drums under them or so whatever. And then now I had to add the thing of, and then I got to put this like LED top on my left turntable.
I got to make it rain.
Yeah, we're making it rain. It's so silly, but it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been about an hour, so we can close on this. But I wanted to say that, again, like watching the things that you do in your career and hearing you describe sort of the processes that go into them, something that I really appreciate about you and the things you make is, you know, I interview a lot of musicians. I mean, I interview just creative people generally for the show, but it's, I think when you've been doing something for a really long time, you get really good at it. And when you get really good at it, you sort of stop trying to push yourself and you stop trying to discover new things. And it sounds like it's been this career long constant process of getting excited to realize that there are new avenues to explore and new ways to do things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like the team behind the Storyville Mosquito show.
By the way, I'm just speaking generally about this, all the stuff you do, but this.
Oh, okay. I'm restless would be a good word to describe. I think that's it. Like I just want to see where else it can go. Even, you know, I kind of live for that learning. Really, that's the most joyful part for me. So the awkwardness of the learning part, like if you think about a baby learning to walk, or even, you know, I've been recently teaching some young DJs to scratch for the very first time. And you can see like, oh, okay, they can kind of understand on a core level what they need to be doing, but the muscle sort of coordination quite there yet. But you know that it's possible. I mean, because we've seen it done already. And for me, sometimes it's not really about even having seen something been done, but just thinking it could be done and then testing that theory. You know what I mean? So with a show like Storyville Mosquito, it's, I always say it's like 15 of us on one surfboard. You know, I'm sure that's been tried in sports, but has it been tried in musical turntable cinema theater or whatever you want to call it? So, and it's really, I don't know. I mean, I think at the root of it is just the human energy, the people power. Even though there's all this technology on stage in that show with all the cables that run from the monitor screens to the cameras to the projector to the whatever, what you're watching, what you're experiencing is just like people work together to make something happen. And I think that's always been the part that spoke to me most, even with scratching. Like the first time I heard scratching, it sounded very futuristic, but I knew someone was performing that. It was, I wasn't looking at it. I wasn't watching it on video. I just heard it playing in a record store, and I could tell this is a sentence of a recording of somebody saying something, but it's being chopped up and stuttered and reorganized rhythmically by someone who practiced to do that and is doing this live. And I think that is the thing where I was like, I need to know what's going on here, because this is incredible. The energy is there. The dedication is there to master something like scratching. You know, it's like, how did they get to this point, right? I could tell if it was more something like, oh, we programmed it into a sequencer or something and it came, it just was like chopped up that way. But this was definitely like the way it was swinging, the phrasing of it, it was like a human performance on a turntable. And so that's still very central to things that I enjoy, you know, especially the live aspect. And I think, really if anything where I can feel that spirit, that kind of human spirit behind it, I'm down for. It could be a contemporary dance piece. It could be, you know, a VR experience, whatever. Like, as long as I can still feel like the energy of the person who kind of worked to create this, and that, and I can find that link and resonate, you know, I usually find something I can resonate with there. So I always try to do this, not because I do like making stuff by hand and painting and scratching and whatever, but I think, you know, underneath it all, it's all connected somehow. You just got to find the heart, you know? And that I think is very central to scratching too. Scratching was always about that, you know, especially when I was starting, there weren't shows you could go to just go witness scratching. You had to go to a battle, you know, or something. It was like, which would happen like once a year or something. It wasn't like, there wasn't YouTube or anything like that. It was more just like, oh, in the meantime, when there wasn't a battle, everyone was just practicing, or they were like DJing at block parties. And I was too, those didn't happen in Vancouver when I was growing up, and I wasn't old enough to get into clubs. So that I was kind of just sort of waiting for the battles to happen, or finding mixtapes or something like that. But the thing was, at the battles, the whole thing was, hey, you have 5 minutes tonight. And when you get up on that stage, you have to bring something that hasn't happened ever before, or that night at least. You know what I mean? So that ethos is still very core motivation for me as I'm moving forward and making stuff and finding, crews to work with, is like finding those like-minded people that just want to bring something new.